week of August 12th, 2002, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 158, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
You're not in London or some other exotic location?
I'm back home. It's been an exhausting Olympics. Thanks to my DVR, I watched more Olympics than I ever have in my life. But it was a really good one. I watched a ton of team volleyball. I'm really into that sport now. I hope they start carrying it on ESPN3 or whatever it might be. But I would follow it a little bit more. And the men's diving was really exciting. The last dive, it came down to three men within 15/100ths of a point. All three of them fighting to get a medal within hair's breadth of each other. And the closing ceremony was goofy but fun, and there you are.
You know, I'm seeing here that team volleyball will be on ESPN 94 right after synchronized gymnastics.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Okay, I had no idea. I was at the gym working out, looking at synchronized gymnastics and all these
teams. I'm sure it's a difficult talent. You know,
it looked impossible.
People make fun of it. They wear the Vegas-type Cirque du Soleil outfits. Along with the synchronized swimmers. And so it looks a little goofy. It looks very Dancing with the Stars when you glance at it. But I'm sure that those teams, those women are doing something that would be awfully hard. It takes a lot of training and effort to do. It's not something I've ever gotten into, but more power to them.
Well, indeed, the Olympics did come to a close over the weekend, much to the chagrin of NBC, who is just getting used to actually having viewers again. Ratings for coverage for the Summer Games, of course, were way up. And not only here in the U.S., by the way, also in Europe. You know, we'll be definitely be talking about the Olympics today. We'll also be telling you and giving you the dirt on the filmmaker Marvel will be relying on to direct Avengers 2. They'll also be tapping him to help bring a number of the comic book publishers' properties to screens, both big and small.
Hint, his name rhymes with Sweden.
Wait, I should know this, shouldn't I?
Keep going.
A very popular musical composer sadly passed away last week, and we'll touch on his lengthy career. Forbes is telling us which of the world's authors are raking in the dough, i.e., they're filthy rich. During Inside Baseball, we'll be going to China, or more specifically, be explaining why Hollywood seems to be headed to China in one way or another. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who will fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And that weekend box office worldwide has been impacted by the Olympics. This is one of the biggest weekends where I've seen a huge correction in what the predictions the studios make about what a movie will make. And then their final numbers, the final numbers called the actuals, come out later in the day on Monday. Over the weekend, you get an estimate. It's usually pretty close. You know, they're usually pretty spot on. They can determine what people are going to do. But apparently a lot of people stayed home on Sunday and watched the closing ceremonies. And the box office numbers for a number of films, The Dark Knight, The Bourne Legacy, The Campaign, had to be revised downward.
I guess on Sunday they said what? The Bourne Legacy had made $40 million here in North America, and it was revised down to $38 million.
That's right. That doesn't sound like a lot, but when they can pinpoint down to the hour, they know who's going to see what movie when. Being off by $2 million is kind of significant, and $40 million is a lot sexier than $38
million. That's
true.
But
anyway, here are the numbers from around the world. The number one movie at the box office worldwide is The Dark Knight Rises. It grossed another $54 million. It's at $835 million and counting. And number two around the world is The Bourne Legacy. It grossed $46 million worldwide, opened mostly in the U.S., but a few small places overseas. That's why that total is different than the North American number. And number three around the world is The Campaign, which grossed $28 million. That's the well-timed political comedy. And number four is Total Recall. It grossed $27 million. It's at $71 million worldwide and counting. It opened in some overseas territories. A lot of the studios are looking at those numbers because it opened poorly in the U.S. They want to see if it's going to do better overseas. It doesn't look great so far. And number five around the world is Ice Age Continental Drift. That grossed another $23 million worldwide. It's at $767 million, which is a ton when you consider that in North America, Ice Age Continental Drift is only at $144 million. So a huge chunk of that, over $600 million, comes from overseas. And its studio has announced that Ice Age Continental Drift is the third biggest grossing animated film overseas in history.
Well, so what you're saying is the North American gross for Ice Age was the tip of the iceberg?
God, yes, I am, though not in those terms. The number one highest grossing animated film overseas is Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs. Number two is Toy Story 3. And number three is Ice Age. So even though its U.S. grosses continue to fall downward, $144 million isn't that much, it's a big, big earner worldwide. And number six around the world is Ted, the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie. That grossed another $23 million. It's starting to open wider and wider overseas. It's at $323 million and counting.
How would you like to be Mark Wahlberg? You know, it's like, here you are starring in this big, massive hit. Nobody calls it the Mark Wahlberg movie. They all call it like the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie, or the movie from that guy who does Family Guy.
I'd love to be Mark Wahlberg. He's a smart guy. He picks good movies a lot of the time. He's a solid actor who's made himself better over the years. And he was smart to take a chance on this property, which could have been very gimmicky and dumb. And he's going to benefit. Hollywood knows he is a draw. And being in another hit, and especially one that's such comedic one. I mean, he's done comedy before, but this, I think, expands his portfolio even more. And I think it's another quiver in his bow, if you will. Number eight, seven around the world, I should say.
Isn't
is
it
Brave.
Arrow in his quiver? Speaking of,
I mean, an arrow in his quiver.
Speaking of Brave, which, you know, she was an archer.
Speaking of arrows.
Yeah.
I didn't watch much archery this year at the Olympics, though I do love archery. At number seven is Brave, the little girl who wanted to be an archer and not a princess. It grossed $19 million worldwide. It's at $375 million and counting. At number eight is the Meryl Streep Tommy Lee Jones comedy. I'm putting those in quotes. It grossed $14 million over the weekend for about $20 million since its Wednesday opening. My mother didn't like it, and if my mother didn't like this movie when it was made for people like her, they're in trouble. So look for this one, perhaps, not to have the legs of Julie and Julia. And number nine around the world is Step Up Revolution, another $12 million. It's at $62 million and counting. And number 10, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days. That grossed $11 million worldwide. It's at $37 million and counting. And number 11 is Madagascar 3, another successful animated film. That grossed $10 million. It's at $550 million. And at number 12 is Prometheus, which is opening a few more territories for the Ridley Scott prequel to Alien. That grossed $8 million, and it's at a modest, but not bad, $322 million, especially not bad if you believe them when they say it only cost $125 million to make. I'm not sure about that. And at number 13, The Amazing Spider-Man grossed another $5 million worldwide. I'm not sure about how many territories it has left. I don't think it has a ton. It's at $690 million. This movie has hit a wall. It's screeching to a halt, and it's going to fall short of the $800 million of the previous three films in this series. So money left on the table for Spider-Man, money left on the table for The Dark Knight Rises, a good possibility.
Well, and you made a little note in our notes here, our lineup, that you just want to know how many tickets were sold. When you're comparing movies, you know, from, you know, one franchise entry to a previous franchise entry, so The Amazing Spider-Man against Spider-Man 3 or the original Spider-Man from 2002, give us audience figures.
Right, well, you always say if I compare a movie even to a film that came out 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, you're like, but what about inflation? You know, it doesn't really impact that much every 3 or 4 years. But that is a factor as you get down the road. But studios use all sorts of reasons to come up with getting as good a positive comparison as possible. The Dark Knight, I've never seen this before. The Dark Knight Rises, they said this movie is tracking 33% or 36% ahead of The Dark Knight, the last film in the series. They said, if you take into account exchange rates. So now they're not only comparing it to a previous film, not only do they want to take into account maybe inflation, but now they want to say, well, you know, the dollar's weaker. So in fact, the money we took in is, at, you know, it's like, no. You guys are really stretching it, trying to make as a good a spin as possible. Just tell us what the movie made, or even better, tell us how many tickets you sold. They don't really know that stuff. Ticket sales are very hard to track. Nobody's ever really kept good records about it. They like to downplay the grosses so they don't have to pay a lot of money to the talent. So everything is kept sort of shrouded in secret. But ticket sales around the world should be easier and easier in this day and age of computerized ticketing. So I wish they would start to use that metric. It would be great to know exactly how many tickets Spider-Man sold in North America. I'd love it. I think it's the purest form of audience popularity. Whatever a movie costs in 1937, that was what they thought they could charge. And people laid down their money to see that movie. And that would be the best comparison possible. So I wish going in the future, they would add on ticket sales. What you'd find, of course, is that a lot of movies these days sell less tickets than a movie 4 or 5 years ago. They make more money because of 3D or IMAX or stuff like that. But it would really put a clear eye on what a movie did, how popular it was, and how many people went to see it.
Well, you know, certainly in the U.S., more and more ticket sales are available, and that's how we know fewer people are going to see films.
Well, we have broad ones, but is there any source for like, hey, you could, can you look up what The Amazing Spider-Man, how many tickets it has sold in North America? Is that available to the public?
Not to the public, no, but to the industry, yes. So rent
track. So how come we never see those numbers?
Well, because they don't necessarily want to be broadcasting that information. That's not something
that... Well, let's broadcast them. Let's get someone in the industry to tell us the numbers and we'll print them.
Okay.
Freedom of the press. Anybody who wants to leak numbers for any movie, good or bad, we don't want to try and diss a movie, but hey, you got any ticket sale numbers, send them to us and we'll keep you anonymous.
Well, and then in France and in places like Hungary, the government actually keeps track of ticket sales because of tax reasons. You know, the number of tickets sold, there's actually a tax on every ticket that a movie theater has to pay. So it's tracked quite closely.
Mm-hmm. I suppose Bollywood does the same thing?
Well, I don't know about that. I think actually in Bollywood and in India, I would imagine there's a little
things
bit...
are a little shakier. There's probably not a lot of computerized ticketing throughout the whole country. Certainly in the well-developed areas with a large middle class, it's obviously a country of more than a billion people. They have a lot of very modern cinemas and places, but there are other areas where they're probably a little more old-fashioned.
That's true, and I guess you're talking about, you must have seen the same story I did, which is that Eros International, which is one of the bigger Bollywood distributors studios, really, they saw some quarterly profit rises upwards of 45%, and that's thanks in part to two films, Vicky Donor and Houseful 2. I didn't know Houseful 1 did that well. But their revenues jumped over 60% to, get this, $47.9 million. And their profit was $5.8 million, which, you know, I believe is the craft services budget on The Dark Knight Rises.
So do we have any idea of how big a player they are? I mean, we know they're a major player, but are they a dominant player or a big one, or are there studios with a lot bigger? Because that doesn't sound like a lot of money for a country with a billion people.
Well, I mean, they released 23 films during, you know, the second quarter, which, you know, ended June 30th.
That's a ton compared to Hollywood, of course.
That's right. And they released 19 films last year. But I think there's close to, 1,000 films released in India each year. So that's really not a lot of films. But they have the big names, the big films all come through Eros.
All right.
And a few others, but Eros is up there. They're kind of like the Paramount or the Fox of India.
So are these titles, were they such massive hits that we've got this outlier achievement? Because increasing by 60% is a massive increase for a well-established company.
Yeah, I mean...
Or was it just really poor a year ago?
I think that they were, for this particular type of content, I think they were doing quite well. The Amazing Spider-Man, for instance, actually made $6 million in its opening, which was a big deal. So those are the kinds of numbers you'll see coming out of India.
I wonder what the Avengers made.
You know, I think $1 trillion, actually. Mm-hmm. Or is it billion trillion? I can't remember, but it's one
it's
of
a lot
the,
of rupees.
Yeah, certainly it's one of the top 10 movies of all time in North America.
It's number 3.
Oh, I didn't know that. I did not.
The Avengers?
Yes.
Isn't it number 3? It's Avatar and Titanic and then the Avengers.
Yeah, maybe they'll have to re-release E.T. so that it makes a little bit more money. Gets back up there.
Is it number 3 or 4? I think it's 3.
I have no idea, but I do know.
Worldwide, it's number 3, right?
I'm going to go with,
I'll
okay.
Check it up. Keep going.
Well, I guess the reason you're bringing this up is because Marvel, which of course is now owned by Disney after a little $4 billion transaction a couple of years back, they, of course, are behind Avengers, as is Josh Whedon, who, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and other properties. He directed the Avengers. And he is going to be directing, I think, 2 other films through the summer of 2015. Marvel has him kind of under contract, if you will. I don't know whether he can go and work for others. I imagine he can. But he'll be working with Marvel to not only direct The Avengers 2, but help them bring some of their properties to television and into other films.
He's specifically developing one television show. Obviously, he's the creator of Buffy. So he knows the superhero and he knows this world very well. But he's also had a comic book spinoffs from Buffy, which have been very popular. And I think his other involvement in the Marvel Universe is more about an advisory or creating comic books or that sort of stuff. It's involved in that print world. I don't know that he's committed to multiple shows with multiple characters for television. He's got one show he's going to develop. He's doing the Avengers 2, and they want to tap his talent for any possible way for possible ideas or storylines or whatever it might be for the Marvel Universe. And I think that's mostly about the comic book world.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was interesting that here this week we're hearing that Joss Whedon, who directed the first Avengers, will be directing the second Avengers. It seems to make sense. And just last week you were saying that Sony was being a little foolish by possibly, they haven't announced yet that they will, switch directors on Spider-Man after letting Mark Webb direct The Amazing Spider-Man. Mark Webb may not be available until 2014, 2015 to direct a second film, so they may go to another filmmaker, and you just thought, well,
he's not booked for 2 years. He just has one film he's committed to doing for Fox.
Right,
and
exactly.
They're like, well, we got to get going. We've already picked our release date. That's what I object to. If he's not available for 3 years, I can understand them saying, hey, maybe you're not that excited about this property. If you thought he flopped on this movie, I could understand that. But what I objected to was that they said, all right, we don't have a script, we don't have a director, we don't have anything, but we're going to release a new Spider-Man this date. And that is what I object to. That's putting the cart before the horse. It's not a good idea creatively or commercially.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they just say things like that as the movie comes out to say, hey, no, this movie is so successful. We think it's really successful. Everybody should go see this movie while it's in theaters because we're already going to be making a second film. That's how much we like this movie.
Well, of course, that they like to say they've greenlit a script or they've done this or they're excited about sequels and they see it as a franchise. Yes, but that's not the same as saying we're not going to use this director. That's not going to get people excited to see the movie. That'll get them to say, well, gee, why bother? They don't like the director. Why should I like him?
Well, no, I think they announced the date and they didn't say
the date doesn't matter. That's ridiculous. Nobody's going to see this movie because they've named a date. If they say we're going to make another Spider-Man movie, that's plenty. They don't need to know the week and hour it's coming out in order to get excited to see the movie. They picked a date because they want to plant their flag and keep other movies from picking that date. And they want to have their schedule. But you shouldn't be picking a date for a movie when you don't have a director and you don't have a script and you're not ready to go. You know what? You got to get things lined up before you can pick a date. Maybe it'll be the summer afterwards. Maybe it'll be Christmas. But you know what? Picking the date first just to try and beat someone else to that date and then having an inferior movie, suddenly you're not being very smart with what could be a billion-dollar franchise.
Well, and it depends because, you know, if you have someone like James Cameron or Peter Jackson say, all right, you can have that date. We're going to open up 2 weeks ahead of you. Or two weeks behind you.
Scheduling is a whole totally different issue.
Yeah.
The point with James Cameron is he's going to make Avatar 2, 3, and maybe 4. He's going to make it when he's ready, and they're going to say thank you. If you're happy with your director, you don't want to wait 10 years. But if he's got a movie to make and he wants to make the sequel and you thought he did a great job creatively and is rebooting the franchise the way they did with Batman Begins, then you should be willing to say, well, you know what? We don't have to name our date 18 months in advance. We can wait until we have a script we're excited about. And a director we're excited about, and an actor we're excited about, because guess what? And the fans will be excited.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't rush out the second Star Trek movie. They didn't say, screw J.J. Abrams. They said, when are you going to be ready to do it right? Let's all do it right together. That's how you do a good franchise, a good series. And then Avengers 2 is actually very challenging to speak about what Joss Whedon is facing. You'd look about all those other movies that they're making, all with different directors, different talent, different scripts, and they have to build that all together and somehow pull a thread and find out where those characters are emotionally and what they've done to bring them into a next movie. That's pretty tricky. You've got a whole bunch of characters being established in Guardians of the Galaxy. So all those movies are in different stages of development. You have to keep track of all of them and somehow find all those characters and bring them to a peak for the next Avengers movie with a storyline that makes sense for all of them and where they've been and the characters that have been created, some of which have not been seen on screen yet. That's a very challenging thing. So I hope that they give him the time and the energy to do it right.
So what you're saying is it's kind of like directing Star Wars and being George Lucas and saying, well, I'm going to direct the main Star Wars films, but then Han Solo is going to go off and have like one or two movies on his own. And Luke Skywalker is going to go off and have one or two movies on his own. So that when we come back for Return of the Jedi or The Empire Strikes Back, well, maybe there's some, you know, they'll be in different places.
Well, that's certainly the Marvel formula that they've done on the Avengers. They built up to the Avengers. They started with a Han Solo movie and then did a Luke Skywalker movie and then an Obi-Wan movie and a Yoda movie. And then they made the Avengers. And all those other movies were relative commercial successes, which is kind of amazing, which is why the Avengers exploded in the way it did. It had a huge buildup. It had a solid script and a very talented director who knew the characters and had the right mix of fun and humor and action. And it became bigger than the sum of its parts. None of those other movies, except perhaps Iron Man, were massive hits, but they were all solid enough to really make people anticipate this film. So I think the level of difficulty for Avengers 2 is even greater because you still got all these moving parts going on. It's an interesting challenge.
Well, I think maybe we've confused our audience because we've certainly mentioned two different franchises all in the same breath.
They can handle it.
They can handle it? Okay. Well, yeah. You know, then let's move on to television, because I'm wondering if you think what all of the...
I'll tell you what was harder than preparing for the Avengers 2 is watching the Olympics. Day and night, my DVR kept breaking down. I had to replace it and take it to the company. Had to get a technician coming out because I've had problems for years with my internet. Time Warner sucks, by the way. And I've never gotten more response from a tweet than when I tweeted Time Warner sucks and my DVR hates me. People responded like out of the blue. It was unbelievable. Had so many people say, oh, you should switch to Fios, or you should do this, or I hate my Time Warner too. I hate my DVR. My DVR is my enemy. You know, it's like people have a lot of technical issues, and the Olympics bring that to bear. The amount of programming available is so much bigger. The ability to tape two channels at once, and with programming practically 24 hours a day, if it wasn't new programming, it was a rerun of programming shown in prime time. You had four or five channels on many days showing Olympic programming, a lot of which I wanted to watch. It was a real challenge. And I couldn't look on a little website. I couldn't go to the New York Times because I would have had results spoiled. So I couldn't go to look at the news until after midnight or 1 or 2 in the morning when I'd watched the primetime events and seen all the winners for the day. It was exhausting. Thank God it's over.
The views of Michael Giltz are not necessarily those of Showbiz Sandbox or its management.
I mean, I love the Olympics. I always loved the Summer Olympics. This one had a record number of viewers. They say about 220 million people watched this in the U.S.
Oh, I would believe that. I mean, I think just about everybody around had, you know, everybody I spoke with had watched at least some portion of it.
Yeah, and that beat the Beijing Olympics, which was the prior record holder. We, of course, online, there was records set all the time for streams and videos and all that stuff because it wasn't available 4 years ago. Daytime television watching was up to record numbers by like 30%. The prime time was up hugely. It was a record non-U.S.-based Olympic rating. So unless the Olympics were set in the U.S., which would be like Salt Lake, hello, Mitt Romney, or L.A., this was the highest rated Summer Olympics in history. And what I find surprising and shocking, and something that NBC needs to rethink about 10 or 20 years down the road, is the fact that you could have all these record ratings, all this success, and the best the network can say is, well, we hope we break even. We think we're going to break even. That's just all credit to the Olympics. But clearly you overpay when you're lucky to break even with record-setting numbers.
Well, right. But don't you think in part, you know, they're saying, you know, IOC, you know, you can't be charging us those billions of dollars when we barely break even.
Of course, but they're locked in. They've bought the next four Olympics or whatever, or six Olympics at huge amounts of dollar figures. And they've been overpaying. The IOC squeezes the U.S. We subsidize the Olympics more than any other country. Our networks, the sales, they obviously make sales all over the world. But this is by far the biggest price tag, and they're paying too much.
Yeah, I would.
But, you know, with
competition
between NBC and I'm sure ABC and ESPN had a big bid. You know, they want the Olympics, but is it a good business? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure that the IOC would turn around and say, well, gee, NBC, you had, you know, how many people per night watching, an average of like somewhere between 25 and 30 million people every night watching your network? And didn't you run a few commercials for some shows that you're going to be airing in the fall? I mean,
there's a very poor history of 2 weeks of Olympic programming being able to, you know, launch a hit show.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. I mean, when you really look at it, what, in 2000 and... Well, I don't even know what they did. In 2004, they had, what, LAX and Hawaii and Father of the Pride, and none of those made it to a second season. And then in 2008, they had My Own Worst Enemy, Caruso, and Kath and Kim.
Caruso, as in Robinson Crusoe.
Okay. What did I say? Caruso?
Yeah. It sounded like a show about a brilliant operatic singer.
No, and you know what? I always say that. Even for Robinson Crusoe, I've always said Robinson Caruso. I don't know why. But anyway, none of those shows made it past 17 episodes.
And NBC managed to tick off viewers with the previews of its new shows. During the closing ceremonies, they stopped in the middle of the ceremony in order to show Animal Practice, a new sitcom starring Justin Kirk, which has tracked well. They claim the people who've seen the episode really love it. It's got cute little animals and that great monkey, and people can't wait to see it, they say. And they managed to infuriate their viewers because I'm watching the closing ceremony, and suddenly they cut away for 28 minutes to show us this episode, and we cut back. I've missed the Who. Sing My Generation.
Which, by the way, when I was like, watching and flipping around the channels at like midnight, all of a sudden I'm like, why is the closing ceremony still on and why is the Who singing? Like, I didn't get why they were just airing that half an hour of the closing ceremonies.
Because they wanted to show Animal Practice. And so, of course, people take to Twitter, including a lot of celebrities, and say, hey, you jerks, I'm watching the closing ceremony. So they managed to annoy people, even with all that attention.
That, I have to say, you know, I can understand them, the NBC saying, you know what, guys, we know that the closing ceremony and the opening ceremony took place earlier today, but rather than broadcast it twice, we're going to try and get everybody to watch it at once during primetime. Okay.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
I get it. And
absolutely.
You know what? On that Friday, I was at work. People were at work. They couldn't stay home all day and watch it, either A, online, or B, live in their living room. So, okay, you show it at night during primetime when we can all be there. Totally get it. But to then kind of exacerbate the issue by cutting it up like that, I think is just horrible.
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely terrible. They cut off a second George Michael song, Ray Davies of the Kinks, Muse, a really big rock act, and The Who, winding it all up. Very annoying.
Wait a second. How did they cut Muse? Muse wrote the theme song for the Olympics. How do you cut that?
I don't know. They had a performance, and my understanding is that they were cut. I certainly didn't see them. I didn't see Ray Davies or The Who. I only saw George Michael sing one song. So it was a little frustrating because, you know, I have to say, one thing I should say, the closing ceremony from the UK, other than the United States, I love music. I listen to music from all over the world. A lot of countries have great musical traditions. Of course, Italy has opera. People have music in all sorts of local genres, and they have great pop stars who are well-known all over the world. Rio's going to have samba and a lot of great artists who are going to get more exposure than they've had in many years worldwide. A lot of countries have great music. But as far as popular music, music that people all over the world know, there's no other country except the U.S. that could put on the show that the U.K. did. I mean, it never ended. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, The Who, on and on and on.
Wait, Rolling Stones weren't there, were they?
They had music from the Rolling Stones at the beginning and the closing ceremonies.
Okay.
They used their music at different points. They were covered or they used clips of them. You had David Bowie there. You had Freddie Mercury rocking the world from an old video clip. That crowd, they love Queen in Europe. Queen is as big as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Well, wait
in
a
Europe.
Second. You're telling me that in Britain, they happen to love the Queen. Everybody knows they love the Queen.
They love Freddie Mercury and Queen. And
oh,
that was amazing
group.
To see
okay.
that stadium full of people singing along with Freddie Mercury, with just a video clip. And they were ecstatic just to see that. But it never ended. You know, up to Eurythmics and Spice Girls, one of the biggest acts of the 90s, the biggest selling female trio of all time. Take That, one of the biggest acts of the 90s worldwide.
Wait. The Spice Girls were more than a trio.
I'm sorry, not a trio. One of the biggest girl groups is what I meant
okay,
to say.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you for correcting me. But, I mean, Eurythmics, Annie Lennox, on and on and on and on. It just never ended. Nobody could match that except the U.S. Nobody in the world, not even Ireland or Australia, who have great musical traditions and great acts like U2 and, you know, Midnight Oil and some terrific artists. Nobody could come close to what they did. Just the sheer volume of talent and artistry that was there was amazing.
Well, these were the most watched Olympics of all time, if I'm not mistaken. But how does that compare to, say, Barcelona in 92 or Beijing in 2008 or Athens in 2004? And I can't remember Sydney, I guess, was 2000.
Overall, it was a record. If it was not based in the U.S., this was the highest rated Summer Olympics in North America in history.
Okay.
So it beat every other Olympic except for ones that were based in the U.S. where you have the huge advantage of the proper time zone. And if you look at the amount of hours shown on the multiple channels, it's exponentially more watched than any other Olympics in history because there's so much more available.
Well, and it wasn't just here in North America. Certainly the BBC, I mean, the closing ceremonies are now, they rank among the 20 most watched British TV programs ever. They had like 27
sure
million viewers watching the closing ceremony. And I think that's the most that watched the Olympics since the opening ceremony. And I mean, BBC was just setting records all over the place. Of course, it's not surprising since it was taking place in England. And close to, I think, 90% of the population watched some portion of the Olympics in England.
And the home country always benefits from a little burst of enthusiasm and attention. They usually or typically or often get more golds than they ever have before, or a lot more golds. And a lot more medals. And the UK had a great Beijing, but they set records for the modern Olympics here. They've never scored as many Olympic medals as they did at these games. And of course, everybody saw Tom Daley, the men's platform diver, do great at the last minute, the last six dives coming through and being able to get a bronze. It was just an exciting games for them. And a country that's more used to, being stiff upper lip losers and saying, it's just being plucky in defeat. They had a great time actually being sort of triumphant and in your face and being winners So that was fun to see. Though, of course, at the closing ceremony, what do they sing? They sing, you know, the Monty Python sing, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, which is really a song for losers. So it's, you know, it's a tradition to sing it at football games when your team has lost. They all break into Always Look on the Bright Side of Life and say life is a piece of bleep. When you look, it's just that's sort of their tradition of like being genial losers. But in fact, they were really winners all around. And of course, the games ran smoothly.
I'm not a big fan of the whole like medal count thing. I think it's kind of silly. I mean, you got China and the U.S. who have larger populations than, say, a country like Spain. So why compare?
Well, you're not surprised when a larger country has more medals. It's natural. But then you have a country like India that has 1.1 billion people, and they've never medaled. They've never had an individual medal. If we had cricket in the Olympics, obviously they'd be a big force for that. But they're not a factor in individual Olympic events, whereas China devotes a lot of time and energy to it, and they are. So it's just interesting to see how different countries do. Obviously, you take into account the size of the country, the wealth that they have. That always makes it more likely that they'll do better. But it's fun to see a country. Bermuda had like a handful of people participating. They were just happy to be there. So that's great to see.
I don't know why cricket isn't in the Olympics, come to think of it. I mean, I know it's not played in...
It takes a long time to play.
That's true. Yeah, good point. But they have day games where, like, literally...
They do, one-day games, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, it could take a month to play one of those matches.
I must say, the one thing I had forgotten, but I'm surprised about, the Olympic theme song. I thought the NBC Olympic theme song, dum dum da dum dum da 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 dum dum dum. Somebody asked me who that was. I said, oh, I don't know. I think it's Aaron Copland. John Williams, film composer.
Yeah, he did that, I want to say, back in 1996.
Or even before. It might be in the 80s. It was done for whenever NBC was doing the Olympics before. And, I mean, that man never ends. He's created some of the most iconic themes in history. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, it wasn't just in North America and in the UK. Also, all over Europe, the Olympics wound up a ratings hit. It was a ratings hit all over.
Of course, it always is. That's why people pay top dollar for it. But if you're going to lose money, even when you exceed your best expectations, something's out of whack. I love the Olympics. NBC did a great job with it in general. A lot of complaints about this and that, and I think some of the complaints are very valid. But if you are going to break even with these Olympics, the value of promoting a new fall season is so small.
In comparison,
for all the
yes.
effort you put into it, I don't see it as a plus. I'm not going to be turning into NBC tomorrow because I watched the Olympics for, you know, 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think you're going to tune to where the show you want to watch is, which, by the way, is your DVR.
Yeah, that's right.
But in any case, why don't we move on from television to music? And I guess before we mention Marvin Hamlisch, you know, I saw this today as we were going to record. Helen Gurley Brown, the editor of Cosmo, passed away at the age of 90. She was, I guess, a trailblazer for women's issues. Sex and the Single Girl was her book.
She's obviously a major figure in publishing and in the women's movement. And she's been around forever, and she was just an icon. And she accomplished everything you can imagine in her world. But she lived a good, full life. She's 90 years old. God bless her.
And Marvin Hamlisch, I think he died somewhat unexpectedly at age 68 last Monday, right after we finished recording. We found that out Tuesday morning.
Oh, very unexpectedly. He was down, I think, headed to Nashville or going to Nashville because that's where his latest work was being put up. Jerry Lewis is directing a musical version of The Nutty Professor, and Marvin Hamlisch was involved in that production, which, of course, they hope to go to Broadway someday, though it's not clear that they will. But that was his latest project. He always had something going on with a pops orchestra or something like this on Broadway or, you know, television or recording. And it is definitely unexpected. And, of course, he's best known for A Chorus Line, you know, that dominates his career.
Well,
that's
as
by
a composer.
Far the most popular thing he's ever done.
Really? You'd say that that's on Broadway, yes. But what about The Way We Were, which was, you know, the song that Barbra Streisand sang? You know, he won three Oscars.
He did win three Oscars. He even had a great Oscar-nominated score just recently for The Informants. A terrific movie starring Matt Damon and directed by Steven Soderbergh. A very fun spoof of sort of 70s film scores. And he was a talent, not one of my favorites. He's more popular, I think, than critically acclaimed. You know, his heyday was decades ago, basically. I mean, he worked in film, he did stuff, but he was more of a middle-brow, audience-pleasing composer rather than an artist like Stephen Sondheim or someone like that. But A Chorus Line is one of the biggest hits of all time. That way overshadows anything else he did. The Way We Hurt is a great hit, a signature song for Barbara. It won an Oscar as well. But A Chorus Line is his epitaph. That is the first line of what you say about Marvin Hamlisch.
You wouldn't say he won, you know, 3 Oscars, 4 Emmys, and 4 Grammys, that, you know, he basically did the hat trick of award. Like, you know, he was incredibly decorated. He wrote scores to over 40 movies and a number
40
of
movies isn't a lot.
I know.
People do 5 or 6, 7 movies in a year.
Just ask John Williams.
Yeah, 40 movies is not a lot. So that's not a wildly impressive list. He's just, God bless him. He had a massive hit, the once-in-a-lifetime hit that almost nobody ever sees in their lifetime, A Chorus Line. That is his epitaph. That won the Pulitzer, that won the Tony, that won everything, that made his name forever. He had other hits before and since then. He had a long career. He had, you know, middle-brow pop songs that he did. You know, he's not a guy, you know, what has he done in the last 30 years? Not much.
Well, now, speaking of people who haven't done much in 30 years, you know, Marvin Hamlisch had kind of a long-standing association with Barbara Streisand. And I guess they became...
But she's done a ton in the last 30 years.
Well, no. Just let me finish.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that, you know, I guess that relationship started when he was the rehearsal pianist for her show Funny Girl back when she was 19. I guess it was in the 60s.
Excuse me. Are you gay?
No. Okay. Not that it matters.
The piano person on Funny Girl. Good Lord. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a legendary story. But, you know, he also had a working relationship with Liza Minnelli. And there's the person who hasn't done much in 30 years.
What? Liza Minnelli hasn't done much in 30 years? If she gets up in the morning, it's a major accomplishment.
Well,
don't
it's
say,
funny. It's
don't
funny.
Say Liza Minnelli hasn't done anything. She performs. She gives her heart and soul every day. She has to be Liza. She's working hard just to get out of the bed.
Now, I don't know whether you're joking or whether you're being serious, but, you know, She's done
Broadway shows and one-woman shows on Broadway in the last 10, 15 years.
Hollywood Bowl on Saturday night. I was invited to see her performance there, and it was meant to start at 8 o'clock, and at 8:25, people were beginning to get a little anxious. And, you know, somebody finally came on and said, oh, due to technical difficulties, the show will be a little bit delayed. So by like 8:40, she had come on and said, guys, I'm backstage and we're just itching to get out there. But I don't know. They tell me there's something wrong with the sound and, you know, we'll be out there as soon as we can. She finally went on between like 8:45 and 8:50. I mean, that's almost an hour late, which at the Hollywood...
That's not for rock stars. That's not a lot. But for the Hollywood Bowl, that is, right?
They go on at 8 o'clock. If whatever time is on the ticket, that's when they go on, because there is a curfew at the Hollywood Bowl. They can't perform after a certain hour. So, you know, they actually have to go on time. And there was supposed to be an intermission, which they had to skip. But I'll tell you, I was really curious to see how she would do. And the reason I brought up Liza Minnelli is, of course, because of the Marvin Hamlisch connection. I mean, she got out there, and I can tell you, she to say that when she gets up, it's a major miracle or a minor miracle. It's a yay, yay. She really just should not be singing anymore. She cannot carry those tunes, and she cannot.
Well, I saw her on Broadway in Liza at the Palace in 2008 or 2009, and she was still a trooper. And she had quite a good album that came out in 2010, which was her and a pianist called Confessions. That was also good. Her vibrato is as wide as a 4-lane highway, but she still had it. Maybe she had a bad day.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Or maybe, you know, she was warmed up and then cooled down because of the delay. I don't know. Of course, you know, everybody's mind was speculating as to whether, you know, it was a delay due to a technical glitch or due to a live
glitch. But she showed up to say, hey, baby, I'm comatose, so don't think I'm, you know, I'm awake. Don't think it's me that's holding things up. That's why she came out.
Yeah, and the funny thing is she kept, like, name dropping, and the way she'd name drop, oh, you know, because she would constantly be talking about Marvin and John.
That's her world, Sammy Davis Jr. and, you know, me and Sammy, and, you know,
yeah.
And she was on Arrested Development.
That's
she had a
right.
Great recurring role on Arrested. She might be on the new series. So don't say Liza's done nothing.
Well,
more
come
power
on. I'm just saying. But the way she would, like, just casually drop, you know, when John and Fred wrote this next song for me, and I'm like, you might want to fill people in on who John and Fred are.
If you're at a Liza Minnelli show, you probably know.
That it's John Kander and of course, the late Fred Ebb.
That's right.
You know, composer and lyricist.
That's the world that Marvin Hamlisch inhabited. That's where he had his heyday, the salad days of the 70s, with variety shows on television and entertainers like Streisand and Minnelli. It's been a long time since his peak. but he had a distinguished career. He did terrific, some very good work up at the end. Like I said, that very good film score. So, you know, he'll be missed not just by Eliza, but a lot of those people that she name dropped.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, just to finish off on the whole Liza Minnelli of it all, it was interesting because I went expecting nothing. It was a last minute invite, and I went to see it. I didn't expect anything or know what to expect. I would say a good portion of the audience, maybe a quarter of the audience, was there because they're subscribers to the Hollywood Bowl. And so they go to, you know, every Saturday night, they'll be at the Bowl throughout the summer. I think a lot of people were going just because, hey, you know, when is the next time you're actually going to get to see Liza Minnelli perform? But the vibe at the end of the show was, oh my God, that was like watching a train wreck.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, she has had bad performances, of course, like anyone, but she's had periods of her life when she's not been great. But normally, if she's a mess, she's just a mess in her life and she doesn't get to the stage. But if she does, she usually pulls through and becomes a trooper. I'm sure she'll shape up and get in shape and hopefully be better for the rest of the tour or the next time she goes in public.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily know whether it's, oh, gee, you were, you know, strung out on drugs. I don't think that was it at all. I think it's that, you know.
Well, she's got a lot of physical ailments.
Exactly.
And
it's yeah. Hey, you know, at the age of 66, I hope I can be, you know, running around on stage. You know,
and believe me, I'm sure she had a pill.
Well, I wouldn't know.
I need a pill just to get through this show.
Okay, well, then let's move on. Let's talk about, you know, speaking of concerts, Live Nation, the big concert promoter, their second quarter profit had dropped, and they missed a whole bunch of estimates.
How much did it drop? What's going on? I guess it's the economy, obviously.
I think it's the economy. I think they're doing fewer shows because of the economy. You know, Jennifer Lopez and Iglesias.
Enrique?
And thank you. I was like, not the Julio guy, but the other one. They just canceled a show in Anaheim. They didn't even give a reason. They just said, nope, we're canceling it. However, if you have a ticket to that show, feel free to come to Staples Center. Well, no reason? Needless to say, Live Nation, they're profit dropped 42%, and they missed all these analysts.
42.
Yeah.
42%. That's a huge from the same period last year.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
And they held fewer concerts in the U.S. And of course, you know, over in Europe, we all know what's going on there. So they held fewer concerts there as well.
So, yeah, if you've got empty sheds and people aren't going, there are no shows for people to go to, you're not going to make as much money.
But you know where they are making money, ironically, is at least Warner Brothers is. Warner Brothers reported that, hey, you know what? Streaming music is actually making some money. 25% of all the digital revenue that Warner Brothers Music made last quarter came from digital revenue of their recorded music.
I'm sorry. So digital revenue, you mean sales on iTunes of digital albums and singles? And what does digital revenue mean?
Okay, well, remember, we're talking 25% of the revenue came from streaming services. So that's, you know, like Spotify and Pandora. And believe it or not, SiriusXM, because that's considered streaming. What is
it? It is?
Yes. And Clear
Why?
Channel. That's just the way,
all right.
The way they are able to measure that makes it streaming because they do it on a per user or per listener basis. It's considered streaming.
So what did they make from streaming?
I think they made $54 million, which is about 8% of Warner's total revenue for the entire period. But
total revenue from digital or total revenue overall?
Overall.
Oh, so they made $500 million in this period. Over $500 million, 8%. You know, if it was 10%, it would be $540 million. So they made like $600 million in this quarter.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
Okay.
I'm going to go with that.
And 8% of it from streaming, and it's growing.
That's right. And they're saying that, you know, the real thing here, even with currency fluctuations, is that the increase in streaming revenue and digital revenue and the sales of, you know, on iTunes, which is not considered part of streaming because that's a sale, that is actually outpacing the decrease in physical sales. So finally, for the first time.
Well, physical sales have fallen so much.
I guess you're saying, you know, gee, when you,
yeah,
you know,
eventually it's going to you're going to make more than zero. So when physical sales fall so much, now finally, whatever physical sales dropped from last quarter to this quarter, they're seeing a bigger increase in digital streaming and the money they make there.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So now they're finally seeing a net positive. So that's good.
Well, now that's what's going on in the world of music and all of the economics about digital streaming. But over in the world of publishing, where people, you know, they write books. I don't know if you're familiar with those things. They have pages with words on them.
Not always. Now they're ebooks
as
well.
That's right. And now actually in the UK, Amazon is out, you know, the ebooks are outpacing the sale of printed books in the UK. Publishers Weekly and has the Forbes list. Is it Publishers Weekly or Forbes? I don't know, Michael. I mean, there's a whole bunch of authors that are making way more money than I could ever dream of.
Well, Forbes does a survey of music and entertainment and movies and other areas. And now one of the lists they make, it's sort of their trademark thing, is trying to guesstimate what these people make. And it's an outside people. And sometimes people game the system. Donald Trump famously tries to pretend he's worth more than he is to Forbes. And other people try to say they're less because they don't want to be on the list or this and that. But they do this for publishing, and they look at the writers, and they look at their movie deals and book sales and where it's coming from, and they figure out what they think these authors are making. They don't have inside knowledge. They don't talk to the people, or they try. People rarely cooperate. But this is their estimate of what they're making. They say that highest grossing writer in the world in 2011 was James Patterson. Now, if you know him, or he's a thriller writer, he has about 14 books get released a year now by James Patterson, more than a dozen. Adult thrillers, young adult novels. He's got multiple series going on. Almost none of them does he write himself.
I was just going to say, you know, this was a guy who started his career as a writer by writing in the morning. And
he started his career in advertising.
That's right. He would write kind of like after work or before work.
Just like John Grisham.
Yeah. And I've interviewed him a couple times. Very nice guy. And he was still in advertising when I interviewed him. And he, I guess, retired shortly thereafter in the 2000s. But when you have 14 books getting released in a single year, ain't no way you're writing them yourself.
Well, he's not pretending to. They say James Patterson and the name of the other person, like James Patterson and Michael Giltz. My typeface would be smaller.
Okay.
Or maybe if I've done two or three with him and he likes my work, my name typeface would get bigger and bigger. And then he helps those authors launch their own books. So he's really got a huge industry going on here. It's sort of like the syndicates that they would have in the old days. Those Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books, they weren't written by one person. They were written by teams of anonymous writers, and they just slapped the generic pen name for the series on top of them so that you kids felt like, oh, she came out with a new book about Nancy Drew. But in fact, it was just a team of writers. They could change all the time. They followed the formula. And James Patterson, in a sense, is doing that in a sort of above the board way. That's how he's able to release 14 books. He comes up with an idea. He finds an author who's trying to break into the industry or not having a lot of success. I know a friend whose friend was a solid mid-list writer. He published like three books or two books from major publishers, and he had what you would call success. He sold copies. He got good reviews. He's an established writer, but he didn't break through and become a six-figure, massive best-selling author. He didn't break through and eventually got sort of dropped.
Okay.
So he's sort of at sixes and sevens. His agent contacted James Patterson's agent, or perhaps it's the same agent. I don't know. But he said, I think this guy would be a good fit for you. They met. They talked. Patterson gave him an idea that he wanted to work on. The guy sketched out his idea. He said, great, go for it. And he's published one or two books now with James Patterson, with his name on them, James Patterson and this author. And that has helped revive his career. And now he's able to relaunch his own series, his own books, with a new title, standalone, with his own name, not James Patterson. And he's got more attention and more goodwill among audiences and bookstores. And so he's got a second shot at his career. Other people come to James Patterson. They've never written a book before in their life, but he knows them from advertising or friends recommend them, that sort of thing. If it doesn't work out, he drops them before the book is done. Or, you know, they work out and they do one or two, or maybe they really flourish and they get success on their own. But it's a fascinating industry that he really has going on there. And that's why he grossed $94 million, according to Forbes, in 2011.
And then there's Stephen King, who is like the exact opposite. He doesn't talk to anybody and writes all the books himself, and he just churns them out, and he made $39 million last year.
That's right. And of course, his money also comes from film deals and television deals and DVD sales and movies being shown on TV. He's got a huge catalog of books and films and TV shows based on his novels, based on his short stories, his ideas. So that's a huge source of his revenue. He had the Kennedy assassination book last year. I forget what it's called. It's the date of Kennedy's assassination. God forbid me. I can't
November 22nd, 1963.
Thank you. 11-22-63 is the name of the book. It's a time travel book working with the Kennedy assassination. And of course, he just came out with another installment in the Dark Towers series, which is his long ongoing series that involves multiple books. And, you know, he's churning them out. Janet Ivanovich, same thing. She made $33 million last year. She has a series called the Plum series about a private investigator. John Grisham made $26 million last year. He's expanded into young adult novels. And also he had a non-courtroom novel this year called Calico Joe, which is basically a baseball book, a book set in the world of baseball. So he also has his backlog of The Firm and all those books that are in his bread and button world of the legal courtroom thriller. Yeah. So, you know, you can see, but he, of course, also has films and all that sort of stuff based on his books, movies, TV shows, TV movies, miniseries. So a thread for a lot of them is that they have multimedia aspects going on. If you're at the top of the list, chances are you've got movies, you've got miniseries, you've got TV shows, you've got other things tying in to take you to that new level.
Well, and then there's, you know, people that you'd expect to be on here. You've got Suzanne Collins down at number 9 making $20 million, J.K. Rowling at 11 making $17 million. Why? Because, you know, the Harry Potter franchise, you know, she's
still going on.
It's still going on, but it's not, you know, in its heyday.
And she made an $8 million advance for her first adult novel, The Casual Vacancy, which comes out in September. So $8 million of that $17 million is from that advance, probably. So that's good money.
You have George R.R. Martin right after her there at 12, making $15 million. Of course, Game of Thrones is his series. And Stephanie Meyer, who does the Twilight series, came in at 13 with $14 million.
13 to 14. You just love to confuse people with numbers.
I try.
Right. So she, again, has the Twilight series. She has a feature film adaptation of a non-Twilight book called The Host. That comes out in March. That could light a fire under that book. It's already sold a lot of copies, but it could make it an even bigger hit. So if you look through the list, you might see some authors you know, like the guy who did the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, or Rick Riordan, who's well-known if you've got a kid under 15. They've probably read one of his books. Ken Follett is a standard writer who's been a bestseller for 30, 40 years now.
That's right.
So it's a fun list. We've got the link for Forbes. You can check it out.
Well, and you know, you were talking about how James Patterson has this whole industry going on with his books. And I wonder if more and more writers are going to do that. People like Stephanie Meyer, or maybe not George R.
I think almost no one will ever do it.
Okay, well, you know, because
it's a full-time business. It's very rare. If people have created a property that they love, they don't want to have other people muck it up. It's a very unusual situation. It's not easy, duplicatable. I think some companies do it. They've always done it. They have, especially in kids' series and romance, you find they create a series and identity, and they get teams of writers to work on it. It's never gone away. It didn't start and end with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. But as far as if you're the individual best-selling author, the incentive to want to do all that is fairly low.
Well, I mean, then do you think that someone like Raymond Chandler is upset that someone is going to write another Philip Marlowe novel? Of course, Philip Marlowe being, you know, the character, the private detective that Raymond Chandler created. It's his, you know, biggest creation, his most well-known creation.
Would it be upset? Of course I would be.
Well,
at some point it becomes a tribute. You know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was sick of Sherlock Holmes. He tried to kill him off. Then he died knowing that Holmes was his most famous creation and probably always would be. And I think if people right away started writing books, he would have been annoyed. But to see 100 years later that there are literally hundreds and hundreds of novels that use Sherlock Holmes as an inspiration, I think he'd find that kind of neat, I think, in a way. But on a very early level, I think you've got created a distinctive character. You don't want to see other people writing that character. It's your character. J.K. Rowling doesn't want to think about 50 years from now when something's entered the public domain that people start spinning out new Harry Potter books. I think she'd be kind of upset. She'd say, I wrote them. They should end there.
Well, Henry Holt & Company, the publisher, they said that John Banville will be writing another novel. And Banville himself actually is a Booker Prize-winning author, so I don't know why he's doing this, really.
Well, he's quite a well-known author. He's a very acclaimed author, but he's also had a second career as a mystery writer. He uses the pseudonym Benjamin Black.
Ah, okay.
Publishing, you know, he wanted people to give his books a fresh eye, not treat them as a literary thing. He thought he could have more commercial success as this Benjamin Black than he would as Banville trying to transition into the mystery world. And that worked very well. So he's going to write a new Philip Marlowe novel as Benjamin Black.
Okay.
So, it's been so many decades. I think it's not a moot point as far as would Chandler be upset. But, he sold his stuff to Hollywood. You know, maybe he'd say, hey, more money for me.
So did Mario Puzo. He sold his stuff to Paramount. And, of course, The Godfather was made into two films. Book one.
Three.
Well, you're right. Thank you. Three films. And now, of course, an author is writing another book. Mario Puzo is no longer around, so this person is stepping in to fill in.
Well, there's lots of examples of this.
Yes.
Plenty of examples. It's all over the place.
Well,
People write sequels to Wuthering Heights. People write new novels based on a character, famous character. It never ends. It never will.
Well, maybe Paulo Coelho, the Portuguese. He's not Portuguese. He's actually Brazilian. I don't know why I'm saying Portuguese. He speaks Portuguese, but all of his tweets are in Portuguese. but maybe he could write a sequel to Ulysses.
I don't think anyone could write a sequel to Ulysses, but you're making fun of it because he dissed the book in his Twitter feed.
Well, no, in an interview, he said that I guess he was talking to a Brazilian newspaper, probably in Brazilian Portuguese, by the way. And he said that the 1922 James Joyce novel Ulysses, he said that, you know, it's really just nothing more. It's all pure style. There's nothing there. And that, you know, if you dissect Ulysses, it gives you a tweet. That was his comment.
It boils down to 140 characters or less.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, Paulo Coelho, who wrote The Alchemist, which is it's sold, I think, something like 140 million copies worldwide to date. He considers himself a success and a modern writer, and he takes all these quote unquote difficult ideas and is able to communicate them to the world. And he's constantly on Twitter.
Well, he's obviously not spending a lot of time writing, so I'm not surprised.
Well, and he's apparently not spending a lot of time reading James Joyce Ulysses.
Well, it's a very difficult book. I know what he means by it being all style. It's certainly not duplicatable. I've used that word four times today. It's certainly not a book that's going to inspire a lot of copycat imitators. It is its own unique thing. I've never enjoyed it nearly as much as Portrait of the Artist of a Young Man or his masterpiece, Dubliners. I don't know why anyone would prefer Ulysses to Dubliners or even Finnegan's Wake to Dubliners. I think Dubliners is by far a masterpiece. And I think even Paulo would agree that that is a wildly accessible book, but also rich and complex. Something that you might not say about The Alchemist.
Ooh.
Well, please. That's kicking a small child when it comes to books. It's like it's at the level of Jonathan Livingston Seagull. But anyway.
Oh, my goodness. Once again, the views of Michael Gilt are not necessarily the views of Showbiz Sandbox or its management.
Paulo's opinion on modern literature are a big whoop.
Oh, okay. So you want us to move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, our first story, speaking of people who aren't necessarily writing, the writer, talking head, and best-selling pundit Fareed Zakaria, who I actually like, he has been suspended by both CNN and Time Magazine for plagiarizing. Zakaria penned a recent Time Magazine story on gun control and stole passages from a major feature in The New Yorker by Jill Lepore that ran, I guess, back in April.
Zakaria, what was he thinking?
I know, I don't get it.
How stupid can you be?
Zakaria actually copped to the charge, though. Of course, did he have a choice, really? We could all go back and look. He begged for forgiveness. He wrote, "I made a terrible mistake. It is a serious lapse and one that is entirely my fault. I apologize unreservedly to her, to my editors at Time, and to my readers." And this isn't the first offense for the high-profile author. Jeffrey Goldberg over at The Atlantic accuses Zakaria of lifting quotes from stories Goldberg wrote without attribution. Is this the age of the fact checker? And is it really a big deal or a big whoop that Zakaria, I want to say, got caught here?
He did get caught, yeah.
He plagiarized, so is it a big deal that he, you know, is this whole story a big deal?
It's a very big deal, and it is the age of the fact checker. It's amazing. It's so much easier to compare and to find and to say, didn't I read that somewhere, type in a few words, and pull up the document that you had. The idea that he would steal something from The New Yorker, you know, everything is at a level playing field. It could be the Oklahoma Gazette, and it's probably easy to find online. So you can't hide as much as you can anymore. But to steal from such a high-profile place like The New Yorker with a major author like Jill Lepore that everybody knows, the idea that he thought nobody reading Time would notice that he stole from The New Yorker is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you look at someone like Fareed Zakaria, you almost wonder how, like James Patterson, who writes 14 books in a year, you kind of know he can't do that, so he puts other people's names on them because, you know, he's actually being honest there. You kind of wonder, you know, a contributing editor at Time, he's on CNN, he's writing all these books. How does one person have the time to do so much, and why does one person have to do so much? Is it because journalists aren't making enough money with one job?
Or he certainly is.
Or is it that they're being greedy and want
more and
more?
The problem is not his payday. He's not doing it to pay the bills. He makes plenty of money. The problem is that once you cheat, you get used to it. It's not the first time. And again, the fact that I found out later that that The Atlantic had a serious charge of him plagiarizing before, you wonder, why does Time Magazine still have him working for them? Why does CNN still have him working for them? Because they don't care. You know, he's going to be on The Daily Show in 6 months and nobody will mention it. Doris Kearns Goodwin is back in everybody's favor. It doesn't matter that she plagiarized and cheated and, you know, did something that if she was a professor, she should have been fired from her job for. If I did it, I would be fired from my job. but he's so popular, he's so well known, they're just going to let it slide.
Well,
so
think about it this way.
He gets lazy because he cheats and it's easier. And they get lazy because, well, people will forget in 6 months.
Well, think about it this way. You have the flag bearer, I think, or the captain of the archery team down there in Chile. She was suspended in the 90s for performance-enhancing drugs. And one or two of the U.S. track team members were suspended at one point for use of performance-enhancing drugs, and they're back on the teams.
Well, I mean, that doesn't mean you have to be barred for the rest of your life. But I think in the case of Zakaria, and I mean, if he was a professor, he would be fired.
Well, yeah, and he's not.
It's a fireable offense. I don't know that an archer should necessarily. It depends on the offense, how long it went on. Was it for decades or years that they cheated? Was it a one-time mistake? Was it something that they were suspended for 4 years or 2 years or 1 year? You know, there's reasonable offense. Not everything deserves the death penalty. So I'm not saying Zakaria should never be allowed to write again necessarily, but it's certainly a fireable offense, but they won't do it. This archer was suspended or kept from international play for a certain number of years. That might be a fitting punishment, and it might be okay if they say, yes, I've learned my lesson. I've been punished. I won't do it again. I'm ready to come back. But if they plagiarize and are caught and then plagiarize again, as Zakaria did, and are caught, at some point you have to say, I need to walk away from you and I don't need to use you ever again.
Well, speaking of offenses and punishments, Google has announced a new policy on its search results. They will now downplay sites that have received a takedown notice in favor of sites that are legal and above board. So we'll have to kind of, I guess, go into what that means. Presumably, it means that sites like Hulu and Spotify will rank higher, while pirate websites will rank much lower, and Google will be giving them less visibility. Media companies want Google to stop including pirate sites in search results entirely, but of course, Google says only courts can determine what is fair use or not. On the other hand, independent observers say media companies often deluge sites with inaccurate and unfair takedown notices, and now that could, of course, increase as a weapon to punish sites they don't like via the search results, even if those sites are following the law, and we've seen this, Michael, with YouTube. Nevertheless, this is a big step forward for Google in working with media companies on the problem of piracy, as we've talked about in the past. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. They had to take the step at some point. I think it's a reasonable step as far as a short-term approach to seeing, let's see how this works. They've added into their formula of search results, they've said, if a site has received X number of takedown notices, we will lower their ranking.
That's right, yes.
It's not a permanent thing. It's something they can fiddle with. It's obviously something that can be appealed on a case-by-case basis. Not that Google wants to deal with that. But, you know, if you took down sites based on takedown notices, I guess YouTube would never appear in the search results because I imagine they get more than anybody. We got it for posting a trailer that was offered up to be posted.
No, not even a trailer. We were talking about, talking over the clips when we were in Cannes.
That they provided for people to use
and
promotional
right.
of their movie. So it was complete fair use. We still got a takedown notice. That would include YouTube. So in practice, it's going to be difficult, but I think it's a pretty reasonable step that they frankly should have taken years ago. I have no problem with it.
Well, you know, in 2009, they received, Google that is, received about 4 million links in takedown notices. In the last 30 days, Google has processed 4.3 million takedown notices with such links in it. So they've really exploded the number
right.
of takedown
and
notices.
And of course, you got to keep an eye on abuse of the system. Once there's a formula, people abuse it.
Right.
Once
well, that's against the DMCA. DMCA. So if you're doing that, you can actually get dinged for that. If you're just like bombarding Google saying, oh, this is a copyright infringement. This is copyright infringement. This is copy. Well, eventually you have, you know, nobody has to listen to you anymore.
Right. But I mean, media companies who even have a fair gripe can abuse the system. But whenever there's a formula, people will try to game it to get advantage. So that's why you saw people have lots of click-throughs. That's why you have photo calendars where you have to click, 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 click to look at 20 photos in a row because it means new page views. It used to matter in your Google results. Now it doesn't as much or at all. And the same thing will happen here. People will abuse the system, try to game it to try to get advantage or to punish a competitor. And then eventually you'll find that they'll tweak the formula and figure it out. But in theory, I think the philosophy is saying, hey, we have a good idea that this is a pirate site dealing in illegal material, not a site that's even just controversial. And people are arguing about whether it's fair use. But this is clearly a pirate site posting illegal material. Yeah, why not push it down in the search results? That doesn't seem the worst thing in the world to me.
Yeah, I mean, my only issue with this is that, again, you know, a takedown notice is an accusation of impropriety. It does not necessarily mean there was any. And as you mentioned, Michael, we had gotten several takedown notices through YouTube for content that the studios and distributors had given us, promotional material, to use in our reports, and eventually all of that material, which was taken off of YouTube, was put back on YouTube. Well, it took a while, and we had to go through the procedure. Well, again, those were accusations that were made through an algorithm, of course, automatically, but that's another story entirely. You know, if all of these studios continue and record companies just continue to deluge sites like Google with takedown notices for every last little thing that they can find, and none of them prove out, well...
Well, they'll find that that makes the formula less valuable.
Right, exactly.
You know, obviously, they'll have to change the formula and tweak it to be, you know... 10 times that amount of takedown notices for a certain site. It just makes it harder to find the sites that are actually illegal. So they're hurting themselves. It's a fair thing for Google to do, I think, to try it out. But you know, they've got a tablet that they've just released, the Nexus 7. They're dealing with media companies. They got to play nicer now. They're not just doing search and they want to have these companies be happy with them. And so they've got to work a little more closely with them. Let's just keep an eye on it and make sure they and the studios and other people don't abuse the system.
Swimmer Ryan Lochte is an 11-time Olympic medalist, so naturally he gets a lot of endorsement deals. $2.3 million in 2012, by the way. Now he's getting a lot of offers to do, believe it or not, reality TV. Lochte himself suggested he and Michael Phelps compete in a Dancing with the Stars, in Dancing with the Stars, and his agent says... Other companies have suggested the somewhat out there Lochte do a reality show around his life idea. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. If you watch the interviews with Ryan Lochte, he's kind of flat and dull on television. But apparently he's kind of whacking his private life. I mean, his mom once said he doesn't have time to have a girlfriend. He only has time for one night stands. That was sort of what she implied and what she said. But I don't know. He was overshadowed at this Olympics by Michael Phelps, despite, you know, he's got 11 Olympic medals, which places him, you know, high up on the list of all-time Olympians. But, you know, Michael Phelps already has a new reality show. He's going to go golfing around the world with Tiger Woods' old coach in a new season on the Golf Channel. So he gets to go to golf courses everywhere around the world and play golf. So he's already got his reality series. We'll see if Ryan Lochte has more success or fun, at least in that venue.
I think so. What you're saying is that Michael Phelps has a reality show called The Rest of My Life.
Perhaps.
Because what else is he going to do? I mean, he said he's retiring from the Olympics, which, by the way, is the only time we ever saw him. And I know he competes in, you know, nationals and other events, and he's doing endorsements. But the reality is he's in the news most of the time during the Olympics.
That's right. That's the only time most people pay attention to swimming, which is crazy. I go to swimming events and gymnastics events and wrestling and things that people pay tens of thousands of dollars to attend the Olympics to see. You can go 3 months earlier and see the national finals with some of the same athletes. You can walk in the last minute, get a free or cheap ticket and get a great view. You know, these places are half empty most of the year. So, you know, the other 3 years of the year, go check out team volleyball. Go check out swimming. Go check out diving. They're great sports.
The late Beastie Boy Adam Yauch is protecting his artistic integrity from beyond the grave.
Is he a zombie?
No, although if he was, do I have a television show for him to star in? In Yauch's will, it was revealed that he never wants his image, name, music, or quote-unquote any artistic property, end quote, used in advertising, and that's according to the Associated Press. This shouldn't be a surprise, of course. On the song Putting Shame in Your Game from the album Hello Nasty, Yauch once rapped,
Come on, do it.
I've never heard the song, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
I might stick around or I might be a fad, but I won't sell my songs for no TV ad. Hey, you see how he rhymed there? Do you see how that worked? Fad and ad? Do you see? Okay, just checking. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, unfortunately, because desires you express in your will are not necessarily going to be followed. You know, they have no particular, you know, you can set up codicils and you can set up things, but ultimately, eventually, you lose control. And so your desires are not necessarily going to be followed. It really depends on the people who are executing that will, especially 10, 20 years down the road. Though hopefully they'll honor his request. I'm sure they will in the short term.
Speaking of dead pop stars, the Monkees are going back on tour. Davy Jones, the cute monkey, the one that, you know, kind of was the lead singer, if you will, He died in February, but that won't stop the rest of the Prefab Four from performing their songs for fans around the country. Usually it was Michael Nesmith who sat out the tours, but now he and Mickey Dolenz and Peter Tork will go out as a trio on a 12-day tour. And another way of saying that is, those are the three that need money. That's another way of saying that. Expect a video tribute a la Springsteen's Tip of the Hat to Clarence Clemons. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. It's a 12-day tour. It's interesting if you're a Monkees fan, because I don't think those three guys have ever gone out on their own.
I don't think so either.
A lot of times, Michael Nesmith would sit out. Other times would be one of the others, but I don't think they ever went out without Davy Jones. So it'll be interesting to see how fans react and how it goes. But, you know, a 12-day tour, God bless them, why not? You know, why wouldn't they go out and sing Pleasant Valley Sunday, you know?
Now here's my question. Okay, in the dressing room, will they still have a locker for Davy Jones?
Oh.
Davy Jones locker, get it?
I got it already.
I shouldn't explain that joke. Okay, just checking.
If you have to explain it, it's dead.
Well, okay, we should continue talking about dead pop stars. In this case, holograms of deceased acts have been popping up everywhere, from Tupac guesting at festivals like Coachella to Celine Dion duetting with Elvis Presley on American Idol. Heck, holograms have been used for live pop stars like Dion also duetted on tour with a hologram of Stevie Wonder. Now, Simon Cowell's The X Factor is looking to raise the ante. The new UK edition of the singing competition show is planning to use holograms of dead pop stars in the season finale this Christmas, hoping to have contestants duet with the likes of, say, Michael Jackson and Amy Winehouse. If video of Freddie Mercury rocked the Olympics, the thinking is that holograms will be even better because it's almost like having them there. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's kind of a big deal technologically. I mean, I remember 20, 30 years ago when Fred Astaire danced in an ad with a vacuum cleaner.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you thought, oh, my gosh, what is how they perverted the memory of Fred Astaire by putting a vacuum cleaner in a dance routine. And the better these systems get, the better they are, the more you're going to see these people. They're going to have a movie where Elvis is going to act. And I mean, I don't know what kind of a draw he'd be in a movie, but they're going to have old movie stars. James Dean could make a new movie someday.
Well, you know, I think part of it is just getting the audiences used to seeing actors that they long believed were no longer with us.
Right. And that means the technology improving and getting better and making it more than a trick and making it some sort of artistic thing. It's weird. It's strange. Let them die. But I can see the desire. And, you know, you've already got orchestras touring the country with video of Frank Sinatra and live orchestras playing his music while we use the vocals from the late Sinatra. Why not have a hologram there where it looks like he's even there more than he was? So it's weird. It's strange. But the better they get at it, the more interesting it could be. It could be creative down the road. You never know. Right now, it's just a stunt, but whatever.
No Jimmy Fallon, then no Lorne Michaels. That's the latest on the Academy Awards telecast. The Oscars were in discussions with Saturday Night Live producer Lorne Michaels about producing the Oscars. We talked about that last week. Lorne was game and reached out to Jimmy Fallon, a talent he'd worked with for 15 years and host of a talk show late night with that Lorne Michaels produces, and a Hollywood fixture with the right mix of gee whiz starstruck attitude and inside savvy. And that's Jimmy Fallon has that. You know, I would say he's starstruck all the time, frankly. But ABC freaked out because Fallon competes with their own late night fixture, Jimmy Kimmel, and they nixed Fallon, who graciously bowed out. But taking away what he considered the first and best choice in Fallon means Michaels, Lorne Michaels, that is, he walked as well. And that means for the second year in a row, the Oscars are floundering for a host and a producer. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal to the Oscars. I mean, they had basically their lineup tied up. They had Lorne Michaels producing, they had Jimmy Fallon hosting, and it all fell apart because of ABC and the change in regime at the Academy. So now they're stuck again. I mean, this is July. By now, they really want to have somebody in place. They need a host. They need a producer. You know, the farther along you get in the process, the worse it is for them. So it's not good news for them.
The people who made a bad movie out of the Smurfs are now planning to make a bad movie out of the TV show Alf. Yes, Alf is coming to theaters. And I don't mean he's like buying a ticket and sitting in the audience. He's coming with a mix of live action and CGI. But don't worry, Paul Fusco will still be performing the voice of the snarky extraterrestrial. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I'm going to crazily say it's a big deal.
What?
I interviewed Alf once. He was very funny, actually. And I'm serious. It was a very good Q&A. And, you know, this is a property where they waited long enough and they're doing it right. At first I read it and it was being done by an animation division. I thought, oh my God, they're not animating Alf, are they? Which I think they did for a Saturday morning show, as
they
I recall
did,
it
yes,
wasn't.
They did, yes.
Terrible idea, because Alf is about the puppet with live action people. And that's what this movie is. So I'm not sure if the CGI is the right idea. It should be a puppet, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they should have gone the Muppet way. But at least it is human actors interacting with Alf. And they've waited so long, it actually is something that people can actually maybe anticipate, as opposed to, you know, they're already planning to reboot Batman. And you're like, give it a rest.
They're going to reboot Batman? Because
of course they're going to do another Batman movie. But, you know, they're like, oh, they want to get on it quick. And you're like, oh, my God, let it rest for 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's they're going to beat them to death. And so it's very stupid. They certainly can't be accused of beating to death Alf. So actually, he had a talk show like 10 years ago or something.
I do remember that.
Came and went very quickly, kind of like Space Ghost. But, you know, it's not my favorite show, not my favorite thing, but what the heck?
Well, you know what Broadway loves more than a hit?
What?
A cheap hit. That's why producers, which is usually below the belt, by the way. just you know, so you know what a cheap hit is, you know? Anyway, producers everywhere are thrilled to see the critically acclaimed Tony-winning musical Once recoup its investment after just 6 months.
And that's one of the fastest recoupments for a Tony Award-winning musical in like a decade or two. It's great.
I wonder how long it's going to take, Mike Tyson to recoup, you know, the investment in his one-man show on Broadway.
He's making $600,000 a week, so he did all right.
All right. Well, one simple set and a no-name cast that doubles as the orchestra are all reasons this easy-to-mount show has earned back its money so quickly, and why it could be a great moneymaker on the road, even more so when it's licensed to local theater companies in years to come. Cats, it ain't. So many communities could have a go at this show. It's not really expensive to produce. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Very big deal. This was a risky show. I thought it was a crazy idea when I first heard about it until I actually saw it off Broadway. I was entranced immediately. I was worried when they moved it to Broadway, though I would have invested in it. Having seen that show, I would have said, all right. But I was worried that they'd lose the intimacy and magic. They maintained it. It was even better, perhaps, on Broadway. And to see this sort of odd, strange little musical become such a solid hit. It's in the $1 million club every week, just like Newsies, the other big new musical that debuted this season. It's really great. It's really fun to see. I don't know how long it'll run on Broadway, but you know, this week also has another big news. The Lion King is going to pass A Chorus Line, which of course is the musical by Marvin Hamlisch. Lion King is about to pass A Chorus Line and become the fifth longest running show in Broadway history. On Wednesday matinee, it will have 6,138 performances, passing 6,137 performances of A Chorus Line, which at the time was the longest running show in Broadway history. And it's not going anywhere soon because it was the number one show last week. It grossed $2.2 million, even beating out Wicked, which is usually in the top spot.
Well, now, just to go back to Once for a second, what you're saying is it's better than Cats. You'd see it again and again.
I'd love to see it again. I've never seen Cats. And I'm looking forward to a revival of that someday soon.
You've never seen Cats?
I never saw Cats.
Oh my God. How could you consider yourself a theater aficionado without seeing Cats?
Well, by the time I moved to New York, it had been on the stage for so long, it really was not a time to see it. You know, you want to see a show when it's fresh.
Right.
You want to see it with its original cast. You can enjoy a show, even obviously. I mean, you can look at these shows that are still running, Lion King and Les Mis, Chicago and The Phantom of the Opera. People go again and again. But really, for the best creative and artistic performance, you want to get there for the original cast within that first year.
Rolling Stone has historically lagged in the digital realm. Tell me about it. You know, I actually subscribed to Rolling Stone and I can't get it on my iPad.
Really?
Yeah.
They don't offer it?
They don't offer it.
Is it a rights thing that Apple won't let them and they couldn't agree on agreements?
No, it's a Jan Werner thing and I don't want to put my magazine on the iPad. Yeah. Well, you know, its revamped website, by the way, yeah, needs another revamping. And apps are no different. Rolling Stone has just launched a free music news app that lets people get push notices on their favorite artists, as well as streaming headlines, photos, and other musical tidbits. Because nobody's come up with that idea before. Wenner Media continues to do the obvious and take a very long time doing it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal in terms of a failure. It's a big whoop in terms of why would we care. I mean, I hear next week they're opening up a Facebook page for Rolling Stone. I mean, the only excuse for being late is to do it right.
Right.
You
know,
late to the game if you do a terrific product that wows everybody and builds on what other people have done and says, oh, this is what you wanted all along. This is what you've been waiting for. They haven't done that with their website. They're not doing it with their app. It's very sad.
Yeah, I mean, Apple is kind of known for doing that. They weren't the first group out there with an MP3 player, but they were the first company to do it right.
Yeah.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, in the past, we've talked about how Hollywood studios are striking deals with China's You On Demand for video on demand. So for VOD, they're turning to this one company, You On Demand. We've also talked about how Relativity Media, the financing company, which has since turned distributor, they're doing co-production deals in China. AMC, the movie theater chain here in North America, was recently purchased by China's largest exhibition chain, Wanda. And then last spring, IMAX said it wanted to install, you know, upwards of 230 giant screens throughout China, and probably the seven-story kind, Michael, not the LIMAX or FIMAX, as it's called. In February, China opened up its market now to 14 additional studio films, bringing the total to 34, but they have to be 3D or these large format IMAX films.
Now, obviously, the leaders of China don't have small children.
They don't, no.
I don't want to wear the glasses, Daddy. Shut up.
Well, you know, 3D is pretty big in China, as we'll discuss here. You know, James Cameron last week, he announced a new 3D China venture with the Cameron Pace Group, and this is the group that specializes in building and providing 3D technology and consulting in 3D productions to all these different groups, to all these different studios and production companies, and they're going to launch a joint venture in China.
And he's tired of the Hollywood studios. He thinks they're bungling 3D. I think they're bungling 3D because 3D is unnecessary, but he's tired of them. He's like, I think he said, quote, we are used to bashing our heads against the wall with quote-unquote U.S. studios. Take a movie like Spider-Man, for example. They'll spend a couple of $100 million on that film, but they won't shoot it in 3D that has real depth to it, or they'll convert it and think they are saving a couple $1 million, but they come out with an inferior product. And we've seen that again and again in Hollywood. I don't like 3D. I think it's unnecessary for most movies, but if you're a proponent of it, you see Hollywood not doing its taking its best shot, and he thinks maybe we can do a runaround. Maybe we can go to China and get them to start doing it right from the beginning. And they'll set the pace for the rest of the world.
He's hoping that if they can prove that really good 3D productions, like the kind, you know, like Avatar. I mean, not everybody can be James Cameron. And if everybody was James Cameron wouldn't be James Cameron. So if all the movies were on par with Avatar when it comes to 3D, then Avatar wouldn't have been special. But he's thinking, you know, hey, maybe we can create some of this really good quality 3D in China. And they will light the path, so to speak.
But there's so few product made in China, at least that reaches the rest of the world. I mean, it's notable when a Chinese film comes to America. You know, you say, these one or two movies a year actually made it. So I don't see how that works.
Well, I think in part what they're planning to do is to actually make films for the American market, but make them in China, or at least make part of the 3D portions in China. And they're going to be tripling the size of the Cameron Pace group there, and you know, hiring all these Chinese
workers. Just like you have special effects companies based in New Zealand.
Right.
Okay, that's great. You want to have world-class special effects companies. That won't change the mindset of Hollywood as to why and how and when they're going to do 3D, though.
Well,
the problem is not
correct.
That there aren't people available to do it right. The problem is that Hollywood's choosing not to do it the way Cameron thinks they should. I don't see how that changes with a new production facility in Shanghai.
Yeah, neither do I. Hollywood is saying, look, we'll be more than happy to release films in 3D in China, especially since the cost of a 3D movie ticket is $19, the equivalent of and an IMAX film.
That tells you how the hundreds of millions of people who are in the middle class now in China, because that's a lot of money in China.
Right. Well, and $28 for an IMAX film.
Yikes.
Yeah, well,
more than America.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, there are 7,000 screens in China that are 3D capable, 11,000 screens total. So that's a huge percentage.
That's a small number, isn't it? 11,000 screens?
Well, they are an emerging market when it comes to cinema. And to have 7,000 3D capable screens, that's saying a lot, actually. That's, mm-hmm. That's
well,
pretty
for
huge.
A middle class of 300 million people, that's pretty small, though.
Yeah. And also look at yes, you're absolutely right. I agree. If you look at the trajectory of 3D films in China, In 2008, there were 2, and this year there will be 30. That's a huge increase. That's kind of what they call a hockey stick spike.
Almost all of them from America, I assume.
Some are from China. Mm-hmm. You know, they had 21 films released up through June in 3D, which is really only 13% of 159 theatrical releases. And however, even at only 13% of 159 theatrical releases, those 3D films accounted for 46% of the box office gross. So you can see why it is both Hollywood and Chinese companies are saying, hey, we have to do 3D.
And it's not just 3D, and it's not just backroom facilities that everybody wants to do business in China. DreamWorks is there even beyond making movies or doing that sort of stuff, aren't they?
Yes. Well, and DreamWorks is, you know, they're headed over there. They announced again, they announced earlier a deal with, I can't remember the name of the company, but this week they announced that they are going to be doing building a whole Dream Center Riverfront complex that will cover like 6 blocks in Shanghai. And it's meant to rival Broadway and the Broadway Theater District in New York or the theater district in London's West End.
And it's not about movies. It's about just creating an entertainment complex. You're going to have theaters, performance halls, restaurants, stores. I'm sure they'll have, you know, movie theaters as well. But this isn't about a Hollywood theme park. This is just creating Broadway. They're saying, let's create palaces where people can go and see world-class musicals and world-class performers and entertainment. It's just creating a destination center for tourists.
Yeah. And
from scratch.
That's
kind
right.
Of exciting.
And I guess for DreamWorks, the folks in China will be working on Kung Fu Panda 3.
That's right.
And I'm not kidding. I mean, that's exactly what they will be working on.
Well, so I can explain all of this. I can explain wanting to build a 6-block Broadway theater. I can explain wanting to bring your movies to China. I can explain 3D cinema and all this and James Cameron bringing production facilities. I can explain it in one simple reason.
What's
1.3 billion people.
You know, by the way, the name of the production company that was formed by DreamWorks in China is called Oriental DreamWorks, and it's going to be a new $350 million joint venture animation studio that, you know, DreamWorks Animation is forming with some Chinese partners. And
are you kidding?
I'm not kidding. The DreamWorks
Oriental. They're calling it Oriental.
I kid you not. I was shocked at the name myself.
Really?
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Has that gone beyond being offensive to now not being offensive again?
I guess so.
That's crazy. I mean, that's a Western term that's historically been considered, well, historically in recent decades, been considered wildly offensive.
Yes, I know.
that's bizarre. Clearly I shouldn't say clearly because you have companies from other countries come here and they don't do a good job checking their English language translations and they come up with names or things that are offensive and they don't realize it. We have that problem over there, but that seems like such a basic one that people must have known that and had that approved and made it for some reason. I'm completely astonished.
Well, so that's kind of our inside baseball story this week. It's really about how Hollywood is looking to China, not only for money to make their films, but also, you know, for ways to release films, and they're more than happy to provide the Chinese public with 3D if that's what they want. And it looks like right now, at least, that's what they want. Of course, one obstacle to 3D films, at least in China, is subtitles, because there are different dialects in China. A lot of even the Chinese films have subtitles for different parts of the country, and doing subtitles with 3D is a bit of an issue.
Well, I know we didn't receive a letter or an email or a phone call from the mysterious Orient, but I hear we did get one from Montana.
That's right, from Evan in Montana. Do you want to read it, Michael, or would you like me to?
I'll read it.
Okay.
Hey, Michael and Sperling. Great show. Thank you, Evan. First, there is at least one valid complaint against NBC's Olympic coverage. The requirement to have a cable subscription to view it all is ridiculous. I live in the country where I cannot buy cable and therefore cannot see the streams. Brilliant. I wonder if they count me as a pirate for, quote-unquote, borrowing credentials from a friend for a little while. Second, great little diversion into Ireland. Oh, Lordy, sorry about that. Third, perhaps you should get your lawyer friend back on the show to talk about Netflix's settlement recently and its connection with the Video Privacy Protection Act. Perhaps someone in touch with the legal community could tell us how far this law extends into controlling Netflix's behavior with regards to social networking and such things. Also worth noting, if there is much momentum in overturning this law or modifying it into some way to broaden the interpretation of quote-unquote ordinary course of business. This conversation starts off very inside baseball, but I think the ramifications reach pretty far with video consumption and sharing on the internet. It's a great idea. Keep up the good work, Evan in Montana.
Evan, thank you very much. I did not know a lot about the Video Privacy Protection Act until you sent your email in, and we probably should do a little investigating on that.
Right. And again, we love Ireland and all the people in it.
That's right. Well, Evan sent his email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And please do feel free to send us your missives, your complaints, your comments, your history lessons on Ireland. Well, we're more than willing to read them in our future episodes. Likewise, you can send us a voicemail or leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher or your favorite podcatcher or in RSS. Or you can sign up for an email. Every time we post a new episode, we'll send you an email. Please do subscribe to the show in any of those podcast aggregators or in any way, shape, or form. And feel free to rate and review the show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. We'd really appreciate it. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show or ways to contact us or even ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is showbizsandbox. Or we have a Facebook page, which you can like. Our username there is showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
And that's where some of his writing can be found. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.